This episode is brought to you by Skillshare. Philosophers have long contemplated the question of if the world is real or not, but perhaps the better question is if it actually matters. So today we begin our fifth year here on Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur, and I am your host, Isaac Arthur. I wanted to start by thanking everyone for tuning in and helping us get to a fifth year. We've covered a lot of fun topics in the last few years, and we've got plenty more to come. I occasionally get asked if I expect to ever run out of topics, and the answer is a resounding no. In general, our queue of new topics to cover expands much faster than we cover them, and of course we often have to revisit topics to update or expand on them, as even a half-hour show is rarely enough to cover all the relevant material. Three of our favorite topics, of course, are colonizing space, the Fermi paradox, which asks why nobody from other worlds seems to be colonizing space, and the simulation hypothesis, which asks if that space and our universe is even real. Today, we'll be looking at all three, and we'll start with a common question that gets asked. Which world should we visit and colonize first? The Moon or Mars, or maybe even Venus or an asteroid? I'm not sure which of those we'll colonize first. We've discussed the pros and cons of each route. But as to the first world we'll colonize, it's not very likely to involve spacesuits and rockets, but goggles and implants. This is the first episode of our fifth year, but the first episode of our first year introduced a concept called the Dyson Dilemma of the Fermi Paradox, which can be summarized briefly as saying that in general, if a civilization can comfortably expand, and has a motive to do so, it probably will. This raises a concern for the Fermi paradox, the apparent contradiction between how old and vast the universe is, and how devoid it seems to be of other civilizations. The dilemma being that it does seem to be practical to colonize the galaxy, and there are some fairly obvious motives. So even if only a fraction of civilizations ever are so inclined, you ought to be able to see their Dyson swarms everywhere, and we obviously do not. The three most obvious conclusions are that they don't exist yet, or that such colonization is not practical, or that there is no motive. A lot of our episodes focus on showing that colonization of our solar system and our galaxy is viable and likely practical in the future, so we often shift concerns to motives. You have to have a reason to go to the enormous effort of sending ships to other stars to set up civilization. There has to be a gain to outweigh the costs and risks. One example where there would not be one is if we invented a perpetual motion machine. You don't need to risk the dangers of the Oregon Trail to set up a farm on virgin land if you already get a free lunch at home. Even ignoring that it violates the laws of thermodynamics, the most ironclad of all our physical laws thus far, this notion is problematic. If you have a civilization with virtually unlimited resources and easy manufacturing, such as the automated production we discussed a couple weeks back in the Santa Claus machine, it's actually very easy for them to colonize the galaxy. So there's less obvious motive, but way less cost and risk. The same applies for faster-than-light travel. Crossing the interstellar void just becomes so easy that you need no more motive for doing so than for climbing Mount Everest or going to the South Pole. Now, visiting a place isn't the same as colonizing it, but I'm pretty sure someone would build a house on that mountain or the poles if it was reasonably possible to do so. Indeed, we discussed that latter scenario just a few weeks back in colonizing the Arctic. We have another motive breaker that gets raised sometimes too, though, and it's the general notion that you don't expand outward because you're expanding inward, miniaturizing, going digital, living in virtual worlds. I've often said this is not a good Fermi paradox solution, and we'll discuss why later, but as we often see with the Fermi paradox, just because a given scenario isn't a good solution doesn't mean it isn't done. Many civilizations might choose to stay at home. It's a bad Fermi paradox solution not because we can't imagine anyone choosing that, but because we can't imagine everyone does, without exception. That's what we call exclusivity or non-exclusivity in discussions of the Fermi paradox. Not if a scenario is possible or even probable, but if it is so common that all or virtually all civilizations do it. The galaxy is old enough and big enough that even if only a small percent of Earth-like worlds develop life and technological civilizations, that there should be millions of them older than us. And it only takes one with the ability and inclination to have colonized the entire galaxy by now. So any option implying such civilizations are common but do not colonize needs explaining why this outcome is so inevitable it hasn't happened even one single time. Some unavoidable doomsday scenario, or some inevitable convergence to a cultural outlook that reviles expansion, that sort of thing. We have a candidate in virtual reality, but for it to truly work, we have to abandon the notion that it is virtual. Such civilizations are not opting to skip on colonizing the galaxy in favor of living in a hedonistic fantasy. They are opting to make new worlds and colonize them. They are building real worlds, because they will only even consider going exclusively this direction if they view them as just that. We've a precedent for this in our discussions. Another of our regular topics is megastructures, and we often say it's far more likely we'll construct most worlds that humans come to live on rather than on terraformed planets. That's where the Dyson part of Dyson Dilemma comes from. You can get a lot more living space out of a big rock by forging it into a lot of cylinder habitats and solar collectors, millions of times as much, enough to englobe an entire star so that it fades from visual sight into a glow of infrared waste heat. That you can do this to almost any star, and as long as you're reliant on matter and energy and expansionist, you will do this to every star. Fundamentally, the Dyson Dilemma asks why we can look up at the night sky and see any stars in it at all. In the 4 years since I introduced the idea, I've kept an eye out for solutions and rebuttals. It may be my concept, but I'm not terribly fond of its implications if valid, so I keep hoping someone will smash it. No luck so far, though some decent objections have been raised, and one of those is that we see those stars because they are supposed to be there for us to see, but they're not actually there. That this is all just a simulated universe, also known as the simulation hypothesis or argument. There's actually nothing wrong with that at all, it's just not helpful since you can't prove or disprove you're in one, and being in one doesn't necessarily remove colonization as an option, it just depends on the motivations of the simulators. Motivations are everything with the simulation hypothesis and with virtual worlds, because the other counter-arguments for them don't stand up well. In a basic look at the simulation hypothesis, we see three obvious scenarios. The first is that it isn't possible to create a world as detailed as ours appears to be, or that it is, but the path to doing so inevitably ends in destruction or stagnation before you get there. But that gets harder and harder to call likely the more time passes and technology improves. The other two are that you can do such a simulation, but choose not to, or not too often, or that you can and do it often, both of which are about motivations and ethics, not capability. But capability matters. We have to rearrange our thinking a bit on virtual reality to something a bit more realistic, no pun intended. Even if we assume near-infinite processing power and energy, which is a big assumption, there is a limit on creativity and detail. It takes an insane amount of processing, energy, and detail to build a simulated world that would be so realistic that nearly everyone would find it a completely acceptable substitute for our world. They say you can have anything you want in virtual reality, but you cannot. The scarcity simply changes, that's all. I have all the air and water I could ever want, the two things that would kill me quickest if they disappeared, in about 3 minutes and 3 days, respectively. On the moon, or Mars, those items are scarce. Here and there, gold is pretty scarce. In a virtual reality, you could easily have a house built of it as cheaply as wood or stone. And indeed, there are probably worlds out there that just barely survived a nearby impact of a pair of neutron stars, and got showered in gold and use it for roof tiles, and farmers clearing fields complain of lumps of worthless gold in their new fields, damaging their plows, and pay folks in potatoes to cart the stuff off. Scarcity is relative. You can't be king of the world in a virtual reality because it wouldn't be much of a world if you were the only person living in it. And even assuming everyone is ethically okay with simulating people in those worlds so perfectly that they are effectively artificial sentient people, not facsimiles, that would take an insane amount of processing power. We might have that one day, but we don't now, and if we get there, we will do so gradually. Your first detailed virtual worlds will be populated with a lot of actual people instead. They will expand it in detail and design, and it will become real. Let me give you some examples. Anyone with a Facebook account can make a group there, but it has little flavor or depth until many have taken up residence there. The channel has one, of course, with thousands of members and hundreds actively participating and talking and shaping it. This channel more broadly has a community. We call it that. We think of it that way. It has no physical location, unless you want to count the actual servers, wherever they are. This isn't internet-specific either. The NFL or FIFA only have locations because football uses stadiums. The World Chess Federation, FIDE, does have headquarters in Athens, but chess clubs don't really need locations. Even before the internet, you could play by mail or just carry a board anywhere with someone else to play. We certainly never question the reality of such groups. Physicality and reality are not inextricably entwined. There are no atoms of justice, no molecules of freedom or art, and while there are quirks of beauty and truth, those names have fallen out of usage and never meant the concepts that were constructed of them. These things are still real, merely abstract rather than concrete objects with physical reference. Even going to those, an apple is a very clear and real thing, but its properties are kind of vague. Not only do they come in many colors, sizes, and flavors, but there is not a single apple left from when that word was coined. They are all gone, so are the people who coined the word, yet humans and apples still exist. Another term with a broad spectrum of meaning, and broader here, where we often have to contemplate people who might be more cybernetic than flesh, or exist entirely in a digital world. Such folks do not yet exist, but I suspect they take issue with the implication they and their environment were somehow unreal. And a lot of entirely fictional places already exist. We used to argue whether or not Troy was a real place, till we found its ruins. But we didn't really mean the city, but rather the story of its fall, which is likely almost entirely fictional and mythological. In spite of it, I don't know a single person who lives there now or in the past. Most of us do not. But we know the stories of those people in Homer's Classic, and who knows how many millions, if not billions, of dollars have been spent or made in the continuance of that tale. How many other stories are tributes or expansions of it? How many of us have read books located in various fictional settings that have what are called expanded universes, ones where several, sometimes hundreds of people, have added details and new stories, often not even very good ones, but the place has become so real to us in its depth that mediocre is okay. It's another tale from a place we've come to view as a second home. Every sequel game or expansion or DLC is such a thing. Every Wikia devoted to a franchise is proof of its effective reality. Why do we discuss this? We are not really interested in philosophical concepts like what is real. Rather, we are interested in what it shows us for a progression. All individual daydreams or fantasies certainly give us room to think that in the future, most folks might have some personal virtual world. Indeed, you'd almost expect them to, the same as we have our homepage or timeline, or our house on Earth. Tailored to your specifics and where you spend much time, but not all of it, and often not most of it either. Those earlier worlds, which need design and expansion, and to share processing power and costs, those are likely to be a lot more detailed and interesting, and get a lot of regulars and form a community. Indeed, you might have a home there that costs you money, depending on its location, possibly quite a lot. There's likely to be rules about what you can and cannot do. No knocking over a local mountain range because it irritates you. No killing everyone's favorite innkeeper. After all, to be fairly real, if not sentient, that innkeeper needs memories of prior interactions and timelines. So you can't just easily reboot him if someone stabs him, because you'd have to delete that, delete it from every other character there, and explain away the time missing. doable, but a pain, and someone needs to do that. No PvP during town meetings to discuss the army of White Walkers descending on the Wall, even if that discussion is mostly about how the new design patch has resulted in that army attempting to besiege or climb a spot 20 meters in front of the Wall, rather than its actual defense. Someone has to be in charge of many of these, and you might get feudal realms run by the founders who first designed it, or you might get democracies voting for who is designing and administering and arbitrating. You might get arguments about who is a citizen and how much they get to vote, or other places stealing aspects of your world to use in theirs, or if it's okay to open an easy entry portal between the worlds of Westeros, Coruscant, and the Klingon Imperial Capital, and which versions to use, too. If you think canon arguments are brutal now, just wait until someone retcons an entire planet people have spent days living on out of existence. Such places aren't free either, and so you can get fees, presumably flat fees or subscriptions initially, the same for everyone, but that could easily mutate into something like modern tax codes. You could have entire business enterprises there. I mean, we already do. Many of our larger MMOs already have their own internal currency people often buy with Earth currencies, and folks who are not in any way part of the game design team, but make a business of it. It would make sense to have internal sales tax or income tax on such places. You could use it to pay the various player designers for their efforts. And similarly, I'd imagine the IRS takes an interest in such new business ventures back here on physical Earth. It would be so very easy to imagine such a world rebelling against external control and taxation, having its own currency and legal system, issuing passports, and even lobbying various governments over things like internet taxation, bandwidth throttling, and so on. We talked some months back about seasteading and setting up server farms in international waters, and how they might grow to be their own nations even. It's not hard to imagine this is where most of their citizens would actually live. And this is before we even get into entirely uploaded minds who have no body on Earth. Note that I keep saying on Earth, not the physical world or virtual realities, because that's likely to be an increasingly vague notion, and an irrelevant one too. As we expand into space, one of the things we expect to see is a slow-growing swarm of habitats orbiting Earth, a planet swarm, as we sometimes call it. Both of these notions are likely to happen long before we have any significant chunk of our population on other planets, and they start to really erode at a lot of what we mean by classic concepts of land, territory, and nations. They also get harder and harder to apply physical force to. You can blow a habitat out of the sky easily enough, but you don't have many other options below that threshold for exerting coercion. And your neighbors are likely to be rather aghast as you unleash Kessler syndrome in orbit and drop megatons of burning debris on the planet below, even if they didn't object to blowing the habitat up on ethical grounds. Similarly, how do you invade a simulated world where the servers are arbitrary and movable, and the residents likely do not appear as they do on Earth or go by that name, and who could probably hide their access with a VPN or similar so you can't track them? Consider it's virtual. Can you even meaningfully have wars without death? Or might that become the normal path for resolving conflicts? Have a third-party inventory and referee a virtual war, ending a peace treaty after no casualties? Would you have treaties with such places? Agreements to reveal actual identities? Extradition? What did they get in return? Did they get a vote on the UN? An ambassador or consulate? Does the company that runs the servers for millions of people's pocket universes with their personal home have to obey search and seizure warrants? And at what point do such places become so real and powerful that they can't be forced to, but need to be asked, need to sign a treaty? We were talking some months back about seasteading, tiny islands, possibly artificially built, which might become their own nations. That would be hard under current diplomatic conditions. But a virtual nation that keeps only limited maintenance and security personnel in some server farm at sea, but considers itself to have millions of citizens, is in a pretty good position to leverage themselves into some sort of recognized national status. It's quite possibly more of a win, not if, as such things would likely go through epochs as they grew more detailed, larger, more immersive, and potentially transition to people who never really live on Earth, just keep their body there, or who do not even do that, digital minds floating around an immense cloud. At what point do such places get to be genuinely real? Whether you're a digital entity or have implants that can feed your senses, or even just goggles and headphones, when does it start being normal to ask a gal out on a date to the Diogenes Club to have dinner and join Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson afterwards to solve a murder mystery? To go to the Green Dragon for a beer with Frodo and Sam and walk around Hobbiton in the Bywater? Or take a trip to Mount Doom to get rid of this pesky ring you've been given? Does one simply walk into Mordor, or are you obliged to take the long, hard route? Such places are not really bound by normal laws of space, or even necessarily of time. Things can be done there that can't be done here on Earth, like stepping back to a distant time, or existing in the same place as someone else, but each of you with a room to yourself. Are you paying for the whole place to be run by itself, with just you and some friends, or are you taking a discount to be in a version many are sharing? Do you intentionally go there because the interactions and details are better, because you want to meet fellow enthusiasts? Did you log on to the wrong server to meet your date and meet someone else instead? Did you get married by Gandalf? Did you get a house in Minas Tirith and get a simulated pet? Did you have a simulated kid even? Did you join a group determined to get rules passed on the forum, protecting all those prized and cherished things from harm or change or vandalism? That marriage notion is certainly a good comparison. I remember when internet dating was very new and weird. Now it's mundane, and I'm considered a dinosaur for still thinking it's peculiar. It's still rare, even in these days of webcams and high bandwidth, for folks to get engaged or married without meeting in the flesh. But with sufficiently good virtual reality, people might easily get married while living on separate continents, sharing a virtual home, and they could even conceivably have a kid, be it a subsentient virtual one, a fully digital human mind, or an artificially inseminated or tank-grown child in the real world, living with one parent, or even neither. That sort of thing is likely far ahead in time, but virtual pets, homes, and marriages or kids, not sentient ones of course, are already a common feature of many MMO or simulation games, and folks can get quite attached to them. We could get whole communities existing around fictional worlds, and that's hardly new, if far more elaborate and commonplace these days. At what point do these places get so real that they become real worlds in almost every meaningful sense? Could future tourism even go to such places from other worlds, because light lag prevents you logging on from Mars, so you actually travel to Earth to log into a well-known and popular virtual world? Some may even be willing to slow down virtual reality time to make the light lag less problematic, where 1 hour in normal reality is a second in virtual time. This we call frame jacking. Using that trick, apparently lagless real-time conversations with Mars become possible. I can also see that trick being used when processing bandwidth is an issue due to overheating or monetary expense. So if it takes 10 real-world processors to simulate 1 second in your virtual reality, you could instead cheapen that up by having one processor that simulates 1 second in the virtual reality, but takes 10 real seconds to do it. The side effect is that living in your virtual world will put you out of sync with the real world around you. You could wake up after a year in virtual reality to discover your kids have grown up and you're now a grandparent. This could go the other way too. Accelerated consciousness, where you wake up from a virtual world you spent a lifetime in, only to find out mere minutes have passed outside. And here's the key thing. These worlds are very likely to exist and grow into robust places of their own, with large populations and complexities, far sooner than thriving colonies on other planets, almost certainly before we might colonize distant stars. They are quite likely to be the first worlds we build and name, far more likely to be the places that set precedence on how new nations or civilizations form as independent or semi-independent places. They may be faster to colonize too, since they have a unique approach to new worlds and civil wars. If you're running a simulated world whose citizens start factionalizing too much, they can literally copy that place, like an amoeba dividing in two, colonial mitosis. You could end up with worlds that were grouped up by species or genre, individual states of larger federations, where their numbers and power alone weren't enough to let them negotiate with Earth-based countries or other larger virtual nations. Likely, many people would live in more than one, possibly having a primary above on Earth or a specific virtual world or private one, which might result in some very bizarre arguments over dual citizenship, where you get to vote, and who you pay taxes to. You might get some sort of fractional citizenship concept. Though I suspect most folks would tend to shift to a primary abode, even if that might change with time, as it does now when we move. And it can go one step further. Whether you are entirely digitized in that world, or just accessing it from your body, for the full experience, you might want not to really remember the outside world, even if just while you're there. There's a precedent in our thinking for this. Most of us don't think we're in dreams while having them. We don't really need to cut off our memories of life to believe in it while experiencing it, and usually at most just have a few hazy moments of confusion when waking up before separating dream from reality. That might be a starting point for developing more immersive experiences that were still you, and that would be a hugely valuable technology. Though it raises some bizarre options, even before we consider things like speeded up subjective times or frame jacking. If you go to sleep each night, or maybe just spend your lunch breaks in such a world, as a recurring dream essentially, might you start to have a divergent personality there? You on Earth dislike hunting and vote to restrict it, while you in that other world has developed a fondness for it and votes to make it easier. How much of your personality separates to that place, that group, that existence? Especially if you don't really know, while you're there, that here even exists. Many strange options, for the worlds and for us in them, and being inquisitive by nature, if we are so into it, would we start trying to puzzle out the rules and physics of such places? Ask weird questions like why there are so many stars in the night sky that seem uninhabited, and laugh off the notion that they might be fake, because no one would go to such an effort to make a simulated world. But I mentioned the Fermi paradox near the beginning, and how this isn't a great solution for it. That might seem contradictory now that we've just finished looking at how tempting and possibly even inevitable such places might be, especially if we could make characters in them who pass as genuine humans, so well we couldn't really tell them from other folks like us logged in there. And that is why it isn't a good solution. However real these places are, and however real seeming their inhabitants, indeed possibly fully sentient and every bit as much a person as you or I, they still require a physical substrate made of matter and powered by energy. The more of both you have, the more such worlds you can make, the more complex and detailed they can be, and the longer they can run, and the more inhabitants they could have. And you want them to run too. Even if you died, even if we all died, we'd want those places and the people in them to persist, especially if they were people, fully sentient and intelligent. And that's the key. We want more matter and energy, and we do not have to go out in the universe ourselves to acquire those, if we can make things smart enough to decently pass for human. Every bit of technology you need to immerse yourself in such places as genuine substitutes or supplements for this reality builds the exact same tech needed to make, for instance, an automated probe smart enough to be able to do tasks like extract metals and build things such as power collectors, processing units, and copies of itself. Honestly, it's child's play to make a mining robot as opposed to a believable simulation of a human character. Such civilizations might come to view Earth and our universe as rather boring. I suspect, though, that this would still be the most interesting bit of the world where the largest number of people were conscious at any given time. But even if they did, they only have to build and program one mining robot, one time, and would have the capacity to do so long before they started hitting those levels of realism that might tempt everyone to move to those other worlds so unlike home, but so near to hand. I don't think this total approach would be likely, that every single person would decide to live one foot in simulated worlds, let alone both, But even if they did, they still have every motivation to keep seeking more material and resources in our physical universe. As to how big such a thing could get, as we saw way back in Matryoshka brains, entire solar systems turned into computers, a Dyson swarm devoted to computation, and we said they are such a thing based on our best estimates for maximum processing power and human whole brain emulation, could host some 10 to the 34th people, a trillion trillion times our current population, a trillion times what our whole galaxy could hold if we terraformed every plausible planet to hold current Earth populations, and hundreds of times what the whole galaxy could hold if we turned every single star into a Dyson swarm populated with organic folks. But if you recall, back in Mega-Earths, we discussed something called a Birch planet, a single massive shell world around a black hole, whose absolute maximum size, in terms of mass, exceeds that of our entire galaxy. And that was a maximum based on wanting everyone on the same sphere, without the sphere being swallowed by the black hole's event horizon. So you could supersize a Matryoshka brain to be even bigger than a Dyson swarm around one planet by making a Matryoshka brain Birch planet shell world. Hybridizing the place, you'd end up with a vast layer of shell worlds of millions of solar masses, composed of a mix of physical places and virtual ones, where some folks lived entirely physically, others entirely digitally, and many folks in various degrees of in-between. There's no upper limit on such a construct in terms of mass. Your size limitations come from dissipating waste heat and avoiding becoming a black hole by your sheer mass. Black hole event horizons are a non-issue until you start getting into millions of solar masses. Even the one at our galaxy's center is only a few light seconds in radius, tiny compared to a solar system. Though again, that rises linearly, so it becomes a dominant factor on size once you get into the billions of solar masses. Heat dissipation rises with the square of radius, and as we discussed in the Kardashev scale episode, this means population density of any giant swarms of habitats, organic or digital, has to drop inverse to population size. Make such a mega Dyson swarm twice as wide, and it has 8 times the volume, but can only have quadruple the people. You're also doubling the time it takes to talk to those furthest away, but more importantly, are increasing your minimum signal lag in a local sense, as you have to spread out more. Neither gives a compelling reason not to build bigger, though. So for a Fermi paradox solution, this one remains a no-go, not because I think such scenarios are unlikely, quite to the contrary, I find them very likely. However, it only requires a small chunk of their population wanting to colonize the galaxy more traditionally for that to happen, and even if they stick at home, they have every reason to pillage their galaxy and those nearby for raw materials, all the way down to disassembling the stars for fuel and construction material. See the Star Lifting and Shikata Thrusters episodes for details on how to do that. It's not exactly unethical locust behavior either. You're pillaging hundreds of star systems to create countless trillions of worlds, or a whole galaxy to make so many worlds it can only be expressed numerically in scientific notation. From an astronomy standpoint, it still just looks like a very large infrared source though, quite visible and noticeable, so again, not a good Fermi paradox solution. Probably a big job for the future though, and not a very distant future at that. Designing artificial worlds already employs a lot of authors, Hollywood set designers, and graphical artists, and that will only grow with time as we are better able to visualize our dreams and engage in true world building. One thing we can say for certain is that virtual reality is only going to grow as part of our world, and will play an increasingly larger role in entertainment and education in the coming years. If you're interested in learning how virtual reality works and designing assets, graphics, and programs for it, maybe even making a career of it, then you might want to check out some of the courses on virtual reality at Skillshare. They are an online community with over 20,000 courses on everything from technical topics like virtual reality, graphic design, and computer programming, to accounting or culinary arts. If you want to improve your skills, unlock new opportunities, and do the work you love, you can get a premium membership and have unlimited access to classes on those topics and many more. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. To sign up, go to skl.sh/Isaac6. Again, go to skl.sh/Isaac6 to get 2 months of unlimited access to over 20,000 classes for free. Act now for this special offer and start learning today. So we started the year off with looking at new and strange worlds close to home, as opposed to colonizing distant worlds around alien suns. Next week, we'll look at another peculiar approach, creating our own suns and stars in Making Suns. The week after that, we will come back down to Earth and keep heading down to explore the possibility of subterranean cities, whole communities living inside vast artificial caverns. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like it and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching and have a great week.